the week of January 21st, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 396, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Gilt Sperling. The government shutdown may stop the national parks and people may not get their paychecks, but by God, it won't stop our podcast.
Nope, we're still totally open for business. And by business, we mean please pay us.
Somebody. And or you can pay us, if not by cash, which Sperling needs to set up the account, you can pay us by rating and reviewing our show, can't they?
Yes, you can, subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, the Google Play Store, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, you can rate and review our show, and it does help us out when you do.
Yes, do it now. We're waiting. There's a government shutdown, so you have nothing to do. Rate the show. For the love of God, by the time we finish the intro, you could feel so much better about yourself if you just click on 5 stars and write, what a great show.
We've turned the show inside out for the past like 2 or 3 weeks now. When did we start doing that? Why did we start doing that?
We're just crazy people. I'll tell you this. If it makes people feel better, I have looked into my soul. I've thought about it and I've decided I will not work with Woody Allen ever again.
Did you ever work with Woody Allen?
That's an unfair question. But a fair question is, what are we going to talk about on this week's show?
Well, we should kind of mention, by the way, that we're recording this a whole day early. Okay, and to do that, we're doing it at night, right?
It's exciting. I'm always available on Sunday nights after we have the weekend box office, but you have a life. And also, as it turns out, when we do a show on Monday morning, invariably during the show, more news stories crop up in the first few hours of the day on Monday. However, this week we thought with the Oscar nominations on Tuesday, there was no reason not to get this out and about as soon as possible so we could seem dated only for a day. You know, we're on top of the news for Monday, but by Tuesday we'll seem old hat.
Yes, well, but you probably should have, you know, told me all of this before I had a glass of wine. But, you know.
No, it's all right. You're the Hoda Kotb of podcasts.
You know what? I only wish I had watched that show now because then I would know how to do it. And we're talking about the Today Show, like the fourth hour of the Today Show. She starts drinking at like noon or something like that. On the Today Show.
More like 10 a.m. But anyway, I'm sure she listens to our show. And what will she hear about this week?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we've got some more from the Oscar season. The Visual Effects Guild weighs in with nominations, and the actors and producers pick their winners. I think the actors are on right now. SAG is going right now.
It's all done.
Oh, really? Okay. So the actual Oscar nominations come out this week, so we can finally stop talking about who might get nominated and start talking about who might actually win. How many films will get nominated for Best Picture? And will we see some big box office hits, or will they all be tiny art films, as usual? More movie news. Ticket prices hit a record high, and we've got final info on the third highest grossing year of all time. If it wasn't for a weak summer slate, it might have easily been the highest grossing year of all time. On Inside Baseball, the star of Grey's Anatomy dished the dirt on her contract with ABC. We learned Ellen Pompeo makes a lot of money, that she's worth every penny, and that she sure as heck likes to curse a lot. Plus, those Walking Dead lawsuits are moving forward, and it turns out the accounting of AMC is just as dependable as the accounting of every Hollywood studio ever, at least according to the people who are suing them. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull info from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, The New York Times, you name it. And the number one movie around the world is Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle. Another $52 million. $770 million worldwide, still going very strong. It's the 80th highest grossing film of all time. And it's, you know, it could hit $800, $900 million.
Who would have thought that about a reboot of a film that is over 20 years old that everybody kind of went, eh, you know.
Yeah. But again, as we pointed out, that movie, which was spun off a sequel and an animated TV series and showed a lot of life. So, they knew there was some value in the name, much to my puzzlement. I certainly love the picture book by Chris Van Allsburg, who's a master, and that's not even one of my favorites. So I'm kind of happy for him. Maybe it'll sell more books.
And of course, Chris Van Allsburg, you might want to mention Polar Express too, right?
Oh, exactly. He wrote the Polar Express.
Yes.
And number two around the world is Secret Superstar, a Bollywood film that opened up in China this weekend. It was one of the biggest box office hits of last year. It's the biggest hit, I think, internationally last year for a film from India. It grossed $25 million this weekend. It's at $28 million, but that's just, I think, the total in China, because I think it made about $50 million in worldwide. In last year when it was released. I'm stumbling over my words. It's just I'm a little confused why the worldwide box office doesn't include more money in it. They seem to only be including the Chinese box office, but it opened in 2017. A lot of critical acclaim. It stars Aamir Khan as a young woman who wants to be a singer, and it deals with domestic abuse and empowerment and feminism. So it's a sort of a Bollywood drama, and did very, very well in that country and internationally. And now with this weekend in China, it's the highest grossing film internationally that was released last year in India. If that's not confusing enough, we think it's made about $80 million worldwide, but all that we see on the report here is $28 million. That's almost all just from its new release in China this year. At number three around the world is Insidious, The Last Key. That's a horror flick. It only cost $10 million to make, and this weekend it made $25 million. That's a great opening weekend, except it's been out for weeks, and it's now at $125 million worldwide. And number four is another big hit in China. It's Forever Young. This is a drama that spans about 100 years of Chinese history. It was delayed for like 4 or 5 years after it was filmed. We still don't quite know why.
Well, actually, I mean, you know, certainly they're not saying why in China. But effectively, you only have a couple of distributors that you can go through to release a film in China. And they decide when your film is going to be released. Okay, so and by the way, Andrew Cripps this past week, the head of Fox Distribution, you know, the head of distribution at 20th Century Fox, he said, you know, it's somewhat frustrating that we can't actually control the release date of the films we're putting into China, but neither can the Chinese. And so this film was made in 2011, 2012, and is only just now being released. However, because a small film like Youth, which was an art film, and kind of a touchy-feely art film, it did incredibly well. And so all of these audiences said, well, if you know, Forever Young is anything like Youth, we want to go see it. It's kind of like, well, we liked Avatar as a 3D movie. Let's go see the next 3D movie, Clash of the Titans. Turns out, Forever Young, though it didn't get necessarily great review, hey, people are really loving it, and the word of mouth is really good on this film. Whereas if it had opened 4 years ago, 5 years ago, nobody would have gone to see it.
None of that explains why they waited 5 years to release it. It wasn't canny waiting for some other art film to score big, and therefore they said, all right, now's the time, Forever Young. We still don't know why that movie was delayed for 5 years. If you do, let us know.
That's right. You can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or call us. Leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263.
And anyway, Forever Young in China, $22 million this weekend, $65 million and counting. A solid big hit. And number five is another hit. It's Hugh Jackman's The Greatest Showman. $22 million on the weekend, $230 million worldwide. So we can safely say this movie is going to triple its estimated budget of $85 million. That's a solid success story for everyone involved. It's an original theatrical musical set in a period piece about P.T. Barnum, not in any way, shape, or form a slam dunk. And Hugh Jackman, outside of the X-Men films, is not a big box office draw. So this is a really big success for everyone involved. It was a roll of the dice for Fox, and it paid off.
Yeah, and remember, this movie opened to not necessarily great reviews, but word of mouth has carried this movie.
That's right. And number six is Coco, $20 million on the weekend for the Pixar film, $650 million worldwide. And number seven, another animated film, Ferdinand, $20 million on the weekend, $240 million worldwide. That still has a little bit ways to go. It's probably going to be okay no matter what, but it would love to triple its budget. And number eight is a film opening up in 25 countries, not just North America, but it's probably not opening up in Afghanistan. It's 12 Strong, the Jerry Bruckheimer muscular war film. Every January now, there seems to be a muscular war film about how, hey, it was really actually fun fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's based on a somewhat true story, and it grossed $19 million on its opening weekend. And number nine is The Post, the Spielberg drama about the New York Times following up, no, the Washington Post following up the New York Times on the Pentagon Papers. It's an insidery, ink-stained drama about journalism, $18 million on the weekend, $54 million worldwide. That has a ways to go. They say the budget for that is $50 million, but we have to put a big asterisk by that, don't we?
Well, because you're talking about, what, a back end for Steven Spielberg?
Well, Spielberg and Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep, you know, if it costs $50 million on paper, well, okay. But, you know, it's not like they're going to start raking in the money and the stars and be like, oh, I hope you enjoy your profits.
Well, so, remember, yeah, a couple things. First off, Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg are very good friends. This is an Amblin Entertainment film that, you know, they have backers over at Amblin Entertainment, and they have to actually make films that are profitable on some level. Otherwise, they can't keep going. So, you know, Spielberg himself is probably taking a bit of a pay cut for this. Granted, if it's a huge hit, I'm sure there are clauses in his contract to actually get bonuses.
Right. That's my point. They're not going to, they didn't soak them up front, and they may be able to claim a $50 million budget. But if this hits $150 million, $200 million worldwide, they're going to start getting their back end. They're going to say, all right, you've made your money back. You're a little happy. Now we get a bigger and bigger cut.
And, oh, by the way, your financiers are looking at it and going, oh, you guys do know how to make good movies that make money, so we'll keep funding you.
I think that's not news for Spielberg.
Yeah.
And number 10 is Liam Neeson's drama, The Commuter. $16 million on the weekend, $45 million worldwide for the latest Liam Neeson in danger flick. Our in-house critic Aaron Rich said it's a perfectly fine B-movie.
Well,
he
is a man. Liam Neeson, I'm talking about, that has a particular set of acting skills.
Next below that is Den of Thieves, another action film that opened up in North America. It's sort of a heist flick competing with 12 Strong, but 12 Strong edged it out. They both opened up in quite a few territories, which is interesting for these low-profile movies. But Den of Thieves, the heist flick, made $16 million on its opening weekend.
Here's my question about Den of Thieves. What the heck is Gerard Butler doing?
He's trying to make whatever movie he can.
I guess.
He's churning out movies and they're turning profitable, so he's doing all right. Star Wars The Last Jedi made another $16 million. It's about to pass, or probably will pass on Monday, the $1.3 billion mark.
What a disappointment.
And number 13 is a movie we've been waiting for a while. It's Maze Runner, The Death Cure. This is the third and final film in the Maze Runner trilogy. Actor Dylan O'Brien had a dreadful accident that has delayed the release of this film. They had to finish it up and make sure he was better and all that. Thank God he's doing okay. Now, finally, this movie's coming out. $15 million on its opening weekend in four territories. The first two movies made $300 million worldwide, just a little bit over that. So I'm sure they're hoping that this one will do the same. Hopefully people haven't forgotten about it. And when it's opening in South Korea, Australia, and Taiwan, it looks like they haven't. And number 14 is Oscar hopeful Gary Oldman's Darkest Hour, another $15 million for the flick about Winston Churchill, $78 million worldwide. Right below that is Wonder, the family-friendly film, $13 million on the weekend, $250 million worldwide. I didn't see that one, but I did see the next family-friendly movie. It's Paddington 2, $10 million on the weekend, $170 million worldwide. So that's a solid success story for a movie that we think cost about $50 million to make. I saw it. It's perfectly harmless. It's a movie you can take your kids to and not gouge your eyes out, you know, but it's certainly not a good movie. And the idea that Hugh Grant got a BAFTA nomination for playing an over-the-hill actor hamming it up is kind of ridiculous. Sorry, I love Hugh Grant, but that's just a silly nomination. Now, though I have to say, the film is filled with more British actors per pound since the last Harry Potter movie.
Would it have been better if Paddington was nominated himself?
I thought actually Ben Whishaw did a lovely performance as Paddington.
Okay.
It's a decently acted movie. It's just, you know, it's mild and innocuous. It's really not much better than that, but it's pleasant enough. Right below that is a big Oscar hopeful as well. Three Billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri, $10 million on the weekend, $55 million. And of course, it still has a ways to go because on Tuesday, it's going to get a lot of Oscar nominations.
You think it will?
No, we know it will.
Okay.
Of course it will.
All right.
Yeah, it'll get Best Actress, maybe Best Supporting Act, two Best Supporting Actor nominations, Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, and so on. There's no question about it, I don't think.
Okay.
Pitch Perfect 3 got another $7 million. That's at $175 million worldwide. Then there's another Oscar hopeful, The Shape of Water. That's what happens this time of year, isn't it? Movies that can really benefit from the platform do a good job of setting themselves up so that come Oscar time, they can expand again at the theaters or get a lot of people to rent the DVD and Blu-ray. You know, they just prime themselves for that Oscar season. And a number of movies have done that quite well. Three Billboards, Darkest Hour, Lady Bird, and The Shape of Water. This one made $6 million on the weekend. It's at $40 million worldwide. And it's looking like this will be the first commercially successful Guillermo del Toro movie in a long, long time. This guy's always been, you know, well thought of artistically, but he hasn't made a lot of hits. And this one looks like it's going to be a solid one. It needs to get to 60. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting because here in Los Angeles, at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, Guillermo del Toro last year had, or maybe it was the year before that, he had a retrospective of his, drawings and artwork from monster movies. And he's got like all of these different, he's a collector of all this stuff, whether it be artwork or prototypes from his films. And it was very popular. It sold out and you had to, you know, wait in line to get tickets and you could only go at certain times.
The geek boys loved it.
Yeah. So I guess I look at that and I wonder, gee, this is a company town. I wonder if that helps his cause come Oscar time.
Well, that's why they did it, of course.
Well, remember, this was 2 years ago. This was 2 years ago.
Oh, 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, all I know is that he hasn't had a hit, really a hit, since he directed that one, right? Yeah, since Blade 2 back in 2002. That's the last movie that pretty much tripled its budget, at least the reported budget that we have. It cost $55 million to make and grossed $155 million. That's not even a slam dunk, you know. It just almost tripled its budget, but I'm going to put that down as a win. That's the last time he did a movie that tripled its budget or came close to it.
What about Pan's Labyrinth? I mean, it was certainly wasn't a financial success.
I mean, you know, again, we're not able to look at the books, but the reported budget on Pan's Labyrinth was $16 million.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. That was the last one. I beg your pardon. I forgot. Yeah. I the last time I looked it up, I went, oh, actually Pan's Labyrinth tripled its budget because it barely did. So that's almost, you know, $16 million is what it cost to make, and it grossed $87 million worldwide. That's, I think, easily his biggest hit until you get to like a Hellboy, maybe Hellboy, or even that didn't make money. No. Yeah, he really has not had a lot of hits. He's had those two modest hits, Pan's Labyrinth, you know, an art film that really scored, and Blade 2. But after that, Hellboy 2, Pacific Rim, Crimson Peak, Troll Hunters. And, you know, none of those movies really made money. You know, they didn't come close to tripling their reported budget.
You know, what I don't understand is that, you know, this year you've got a whole bunch of people saying, oh, there's no front runners for the Oscar. I'm like, I don't know. I keep hearing about Three Billboards and The Shape of Water. That's all I hear about. And a little bit of Lady Bird sprinkled in. But those are the three films I hear about. So I don't know what you're talking about. No front runners.
Well, they don't say no front runners. They say no front runner. Right.
Right. Okay. Well, yes.
I mean,
correct.
It's not a wide open race. It's pretty clearly, you know, like you say, Three Billboards, The Shape of Water, Lady Bird, and to a lesser degree, Dunkirk, and perhaps Get Out and Call Me by Your Name.
That's it. I'm voting for Greatest Showman.
And at the last slot in our box office hit is A Better Tomorrow, a Chinese action remake of the John Woo classic, which opened up to about $8 million. I think it opened up on Wednesday. So that's our box office. And speaking of The Greatest Showman, which you're about to vote for Best Picture, the soundtrack has been number one for 2 weeks in a row. That's kind of amazing. That's, you know, that doesn't happen a lot for a movie like this with an original songs that are not done by a lot of, you know, this is a movie musical and its soundtrack has hit number one thanks to actual sales, a lot of it. I mean, it's streaming as well, but a lot of it seems to be actual physical sales of the soundtrack. So people who see the movie like it a lot.
Yeah, you know, my daughter just got back from a birthday party and said that, you know, what they listened to at the birthday party was the soundtrack for The Greatest Showman, and now she wants to go see the movie.
Oh, really?
Yes.
That's really interesting, you know, and if they go, they won't have to pay full price. They'll be kids.
That's right.
But, you know, movie tickets are more expensive than ever. The average ticket price in North America was $8.97, or as we like to say, $9.
Right. Well, and that's the reason why, you know, circuits or, you know, exhibition cinema chains like Regal, yes, they had, you know, lower attendance by, like, you know, 6.7% last year, and their box office dropped 2.6%, and their concession sales dropped 0.3%. But the reason that box office didn't drop as much as attendance is because of higher ticket prices.
And not so much 3D and IMAX.
No. They just basically basically priced everything higher.
However, if you compare it to 1977, 40 years ago, back then the average ticket price adjusted for inflation was $9.40. So tickets are the same as they were 40 years ago, maybe a little bit less even. It was the actual ticket price was $2.23. That was the average back in 1977 when people were flocking to Star Wars. But, you know, adjust for inflation, it's about the same price as today. So are tickets more expensive? Not really, not if you adjust for inflation.
Yeah, I don't think, certainly everybody is saying how expensive they are. And, you know, I went to the ICTA last week. It's a seminar series of lots of studios, lots of movie theater owners, lots of, movie theater manufacturers, meaning they make projectors and servers and things that show movies. And they had a panel of students from college who said, look, if tickets cost less, they'd go more. And one person on the panel, one of the students said, well, I just use MoviePass now. And like all the other five people on the panel were like, what's MoviePass? And I just thought, well, apparently students need to learn how to read.
Well, studios know how to read, and what matters is not the total box office. They don't care about concession sales. All they care about are their own individual movies. And when you break it down by studio, Disney had a great year and Universal had a great year. You know, they had a lot of hits. Sony, Fox, Warner Brothers, they were fine. You know, they had more hits than flops, but, you know, they lost. And the ones they lost on weren't really the big ticket ones necessarily, or they sort of broke even with them. So they didn't have a bad year. They had a fine, okay year. You can't be on top every year. And one studio, Paramount, had a dreadful year.
Well,
you know,
first
they had
of
11
all,
films, 4 were hits, and 7 were flops. Their hits were Baywatch, Triple X, you know, the Vin Diesel movie, Rings, and the very modest An Inconvenient Sequel documentary. So they really had 3 commercial hits and 7 flops. So that's not good. Everybody else did okay to great.
Well, if you want to know how good Disney did last year, here's a little bit of a trivia, a little tidbit for you. In the country of Argentina, all of the admissions last year, okay, Disney got 77% of all admissions in the country of Argentina last year. Yeah.
Well, but Argentina, of course, yeah, they have a wow, that's a lot of money. But it's hard to get the money out of Argentina,
well,
right?
Well, yeah, but I'm just trying to say, like, even in a country like that, which is a fine country, I'm just saying, even, you know, if you segment these countries and look at just one territory, 77% admissions.
They were the biggest two, but that's a little unusual. Most countries, that wouldn't come down to 77% of the box office for Disney.
Probably
that's
not.
That's sort of an outlier, right? Yeah, they didn't get.
Well, remember, they made a conscious choice to only go with franchise properties. That was their.
Well, I don't think that's different decision. That's not different than most of the others, right? I mean, Universal isn't making a lot of tiny art films. They're doing mostly franchise flicks, aren't they?
No, in fact, I just saw in the Los Angeles Times a story called, "The Spec Script is Dead," and the spec script is when screenwriters will write a story totally on their own without anybody paying them to do so, and then they'll go sell it to a studio. Well, usually that whatever they're writing is, you know, completely made up and has no IP, intellectual property behind it. It isn't based on a book.
Right, they can't.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's completely, You've Got Mail, although that was actually based on a
remake.
Movie. Yeah, so I should, bad example. Sleepless in Seattle, spec script. Perfect example.
Get Out.
Yeah. Spec script. They're saying, look, that's going away.
But it's not.
I agree. I think it's just, there's a lull. It will come back. Maybe it'll be Amazon. Maybe it'll be Netflix. Maybe it'll be somebody else. Spec scripts aren't going anywhere. People aren't going to stop writing.
Right. But when they do, sometimes they're big and flashy and need a lot of special effects. It's not usually just art films. Sometimes it is big movies. They're just new tent poles, or at least tent poles in the making. And that's where the Visual Effects Society steps in. They had their awards. They've got nominations for the top visual effects of the year. When we look at the Oscar nominations on Tuesday, we can expect to see these movies in the running. Tell us, who got the nominations for the best visual effects in a photoreal feature, which is their word for not animated?
Well, of course, Blade Runner 2049. That was, let's face it, it looked pretty darn good. Guardians of the Galaxy 2, Kong Skull Island, Star Wars The Last Jedi, and War for the Planet of the Apes. I think it's going to be down to Blade Runner 2049 and War for the Planet of the Apes.
If I was voting, I would vote for War for the Planet of the Apes. They both looked great, but the achievement of Planet of the Apes to me is pretty amazing.
Just that all the apes looked real?
Well, the full performances, the complex nuance, the everything about the photo capturing and these characters that they created was just pretty striking. So to me, that was the best achievement. Blade Runner 2049 was an awesome looking movie, no doubt about it. Star Wars The Last Jedi, no way, because they had Princess Leia flying through space, and I can't forgive that.
Yeah, what was that? It's funny that you should mention that, because it was one of those throwaway scenes that, frankly, when I went back and thought about the film in my own mind, I was like, that was probably the dumbest part of the whole movie. And there were some moments in that movie where I was like, what the hell? And that was definitely a questionable one.
That wasn't a throwaway scene. That was like a crucial moment of the film, and it was a jump the shark moment. What about outstanding supporting visual effects in a photoreal feature? So this is a movie not dominated by visual effects, but they need them. So they're not the flashy spectacles like Blade Runner and Planet of the Apes, but they do use special effects, as does virtually every film. So in this case, you're looking at more quiet movies like Darkest Hour, Downsizing, Dunkirk, Mother, and Only the Brave.
Well, okay. I'm going to have to defer on Downsizing. I'm going to have to defer on Mother and say, I have no idea who's going to win this one. Maybe Downsizing.
Are you talking about who the Visual Effects Society is going to choose, or the Oscars? Because these are just the Visual Effects Society.
I'm talking about the Visual Effects Society. I have no idea who.
Right. And your favorite is?
My favorite is probably Dunkirk probably Dunkirk, because they had to make everything look like it was 1944.
No, I thought Dunkirk was tremendous. I would absolutely vote for it. In fact, in Downsizing, what struck me was how when you had big people in the same shot with little people, how you felt like you could actually see the blue screen steal. I'm stumbling over my words, but I was kind of surprised that you couldn't do an easier job of like having a big nurse say, hey guys, how you doing? Talking to the little nurses, and you could just see the screen practically where the adult, they'd filmed one person and put the people in front of it and had a blue screen. It did not look convincing to me. I thought it had some really cool production design where when you were in the little world, that they made it look like almost little world stuff. Somehow they were just there next to a house and a car, and they were real houses and real cars, but they kind of looked handmade or little tiny ones, even though everything was in proportion. And I thought that was very subtle, nice production design. But overall, I was not impressed by the special effects when you had big people standing next to little people.
And by the way, before somebody writes in and tells me that Dunkirk did not take place in the 1944, I know it was in the 30s. So
actually, Dunkirk took place in May of 1940.
Well, like I said, 1940, just as I was saying.
And best animated film, Captain Underpants, Cars 3, Coco, Despicable Me 3, and two Lego movies, Batman movie and Ninjago movie. Probably, I think out of those five or six, it's clearly going to be Coco.
Yes, I would agree.
And the Producers Guild, they weighed in. They made their winners announced, right? We got SAG coming up and Producers Guild. These matter a lot. I mean, the Visual Effects Society obviously is going to have a lot of overlap with the Oscar people. I'm sure it's probably a bigger pool of voters, but the Producers Guild and the SAG Awards both are, pretty good indicators of who might be getting nominations on Tuesday. The Producers Guild named their best picture, That's the Shape of Water. SAG named their best picture, It's Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Right. So I guess when you look at it, again, you have your front runners.
Yeah, they're certainly in the mix. Absolutely. Those are two clearly ones that are way up there. Best animated film, Coco. That's what the Producers Guild picked. SAG did not weigh in because they don't value voice actors. Isn't that a shame? Best documentary from the Producers Guild was Jane. But the SAG people weighed in on the actual acting nominations. Gary Oldman won for Best Actor. Frances McDormand for Best Actress. She was joined by her co-star in Three Billboards, Sam Rockwell, even though I liked Woody Harrelson better in that movie. And Best Supporting Actress was Allison Janney for I, Tonya, which I also saw this weekend.
Oh, really? And what did you think?
Thank you, MoviePass. Hey, let's go to the movies
again
and again. I liked I, Tonya. I thought it was fun. I didn't love it, but I enjoyed it quite a bit. And I really liked all the performances. I liked her husband. I liked the coach. I thought, of course, Margot Robbie and Allison Janney were both very good too. I was just really impressed by the ensemble. I thought everybody in that movie was really good. I felt like the movie captured her point of view without being just her point of view. So I thought that was pretty worthwhile. You know, it was fun black comedy. It didn't make light or fun, you know, bizarre people criticizing it. Oh, it's classist or it doesn't. It's like, no, it's totally presents, you know, the argument of how she was treated poorly because of the class she came from.
Well, let's face it. We don't think I, Tonya is going to be nominated for Best Picture. I think we could both agree on that.
No, I don't agree with that at all. I think it could be. Why not?
Okay,
absolutely. You're going to get a Best Actress, a Best Supporting Actress,
Best Picture,
probably Best Original Screenplay, and why not? It could get a Best Picture. Sure, I think it's in the mix.
Okay, well,
I think that's one of them.
One of the questions you ask, and we've talked about, previously, is, well, they've expanded the Best Picture category to 10 films in hopes of getting a Wonder Woman or a Get Out, you know, some big blockbuster films in that, you know, something that will attract the audiences to the telecast. So this year, what do you think? Will we see some of those movies nominated on Tuesday or not?
I think it'll really be a disappointment if you don't see either Get Out or Wonder Woman in the mix. Get Out probably has the better chance because it's really been, you know, critically acclaimed and been a buzzworthy movie and did so well at the box office and has a very obvious social context to it that, you know, any idiot can say, oh, it's a horror film and it's entertaining, but it actually has something on its mind. And so I think Oscar voters will be attracted to that. That seems to be the most likely one, if not Wonder Woman, which, you know, could be in the mix for Best Picture and Director and so on. At the very least, you would hope it would be in the mix. If one of those doesn't get in, you just have to say, you know what, Oscar's just going to have to accept that when you expand to 10 and you get 10 best films of the year, you're still probably going to end up with 10 small art films that are the sort of movies studios used to make all the time. You know, timely films, biopics, things like that. Those are still the movies that Oscar voters care about. And, you know, this year, if you were going to expand the list and say, well, what else could be in the mix? They won't be. But Logan certainly should be in the mix. That was one of the best reviewed movies of the year. Coco, which I didn't even like. These are not movies we're pushing because we like them necessarily. I thought the second half of Wonder Woman was weak. But as far as a popular film with great reviews that could be in the mix for Best Picture and deserve to be in terms of box office and what most people thought about them, you know, Coco. And frankly, I thought the best, you know, superhero movie of the year was Spider-Man Homecoming. The kid was great. The movie made a ton of money. It got great reviews. Michael Keaton had a great supporting actor turn as a villain. He should be in the mix for Best Supporting Actor, but that doesn't have a hope in hell of being up in the mix. And also War for the Planet of the Apes, which finished off a really good trilogy. You know, so, you know, those are six movies that are probably the sort of film they hoped would be in the mix. At least Get Out and Wonder Woman should be in there. If one of them doesn't make it, that's really going to be a sad commentary.
Well, one of the things that it is being made is Party of Five, the reboot.
That's right. We've talked about this before. Party of Five is going to Freeform with the original creative talent who created the original show involved. And Bad Boys is transitioning to Bad Girls, so we want to be supportive of that. It's going to star Gabrielle Union, and it's going to be on NBC. So that movie has turned into a TV series. It's also transitioned to a new gender, or perhaps it's the gender it always was. Here I am making fun of people who are transgender. I'm not. I'm just saying this movie got a gender flip, and now it's a TV show. It stars Gabrielle Union, and that's going straight to series at NBC. So the reboots, the remakes, the sequels, the spinoffs, they never stop.
Well, now we talked about Woody Allen and some of these actors and actresses who say, well, we're not going to work with him again. But here's something interesting. Director Kevin Smith has decided to become poor because he's donating residuals to films he worked on with Harvey Weinstein to women in film. But I think like all of his films are with Harvey Weinstein. So I don't know how he'll ever get a royalty again.
Well, that is a big step. I mean, their annuities, of course, you know, Clerks and things like that and Mallrats. One could be cynical and say, well, You know, they made most of their money back in the day. He's probably not seeing as much money anymore. But for a guy who doesn't have big projects and makes small budget movies and TV shows, it still is probably a significant source of his revenue. So that's a really big step. That's certainly not the step other actors have said. But first, we had the actors in his latest film. Rebecca Hall and Griffin Newman said, we probably wouldn't work with Woody Allen ever again. And now Timothy Chalamet, who's in his latest film, also said he wouldn't work with him again and felt like he'd learned a lesson in how to value a project versus, you know, real life and what matters. Colin Firth said, I'll never work with Woody again. Chloe Sevigny said, I'll probably not ever work with him again. It's like everybody who's ever worked with Woody Allen's like, I'm never working with him again. I feel like Woody said, well, you know, you can work for free. You know, like, why didn't you? I'd be like, well, hey, why didn't you tell me you weren't going to work with me again? You know, why not work for nothing? You know, why not work for scale if you want to feel like you're being more noble?
Or better yet, I'm surprised you didn't say, I never asked anyway. You know, yeah. I didn't ask you again. So I don't know why you're turning me down.
But we've had our own offstage discussion about Woody Allen. We don't need to go in it again, but it will be interesting to see his next movie, not the one that's already shot, but who's going to make his next movie. Suddenly, like, you know, that's a poisonous thing to do and people are going to question you. That's clearly the mood in Hollywood at the moment, at least for people who have worked on Woody Allen films. Who's going to say, yeah, you know what? I can't judge him. It was adjudicated in court. He was not found guilty. I can't look into the souls of everyone. And I feel like I can work with him.
And for 24 years, you decided it was okay to make movies with him. And then all of a sudden now there's this Me Too movement.
That was before there were accusations. It's not 24 years since the accusations.
Yeah, 1994.
No, that's when he was first accused.
Yes, 1994.
Well, they're saying I made a mistake. People aren't allowed to grow and change and say, well, you know what? And then it didn't bother me. Now it bothers me. You know, no one has to defend not working with someone. No one has to defend reading a book by somebody or listening to it. You know, if you read a book or watch a movie or listen to an album, you're not saying I morally approve of the people who created it. You know, that's not what you're saying. It's only natural. If somebody does something while you're alive and you think, wow, what a jerk. That may make you like their work less. And it's not like we all run out to say, I want to read a book by a pedophile. I want to see a piece of art by a jerk who mistreats his wife. You know, no, we don't do that. And it's normal if maybe you say, the more I learn about Mel Gibson, the less I enjoy Gallipoli. You know, that's normal. That's natural. And if you do that, fine. But if you tell everyone else, you must morally judge the private lives of every artist before you have any right to watch their movies or enjoy Hannah and Her Sisters, well, that's kind of crazy.
Well, certainly the Producers Guild is trying to draw a line in the sand. They have new sexual misconduct guidelines, so they're going to tell you exactly what you can and cannot do when you're working.
They're like, do not harass people.
Yeah, pretty so easy, pretty simple.
They have training for all crew on sexual harassment and assault before every project and before every new season of an ongoing project like a TV show. So you're starting season 2 of a TV show, you got to do it again. They want to have 2 people on set, preferably of the different gender, who can be approached with issues that people have. So you've got a named man and a named woman, or perhaps a named man and a named intersex person, but 2 different people that crew members can quietly approach and say, you know what, the DP is doing this, or the costume person is doing this, or the director is doing this, or the star is doing this, and I'm uncomfortable with it. So that's an interesting new step. And here's another big step that is long overdue. All meetings should be held in a comfortable, safe environment.
Well, you know what? I happen to think that my hotel room is comfortable and safe.
Right. Well, that would be comfortable and safe if there are 10 people there and you're not wearing a bathrobe.
I'm kidding, of course. You know that,
no,
right?
No, you're not kidding, because people work out of hotel rooms. They have meetings in hotel rooms. It's not so crazy. You think, who would ever go to a hotel room? Well, you know what? You're in Cannes. They're in their hotel room. That's where the office is. And there's 50 people running in and out. It's not a weird thing unless they're the only one there. Their assistant leaves 5 minutes later. Then it's not a comfortable, safe environment. So no more of that. No more. And, you know, if you can meet somewhere other than a hotel room or their home, great. But low budget movies or films where you're on location, you may have a meeting in a hotel room. There better be a lot of people there and it better be professional. If it's you and the director one-on-one, that is not a comfortable, safe environment. So, you know, we talk about it a lot. There's a good essay in The Guardian about Aziz Ansari. We talked about him a little bit last week. This person says, quote, assault is not a feeling. The Aziz Ansari story shows why language matters. And what I like about the piece by Tiffany Wright is it's very interesting and thoughtful, but she's not demonizing the woman or chiding her for telling her story, because I don't want to do that either. It's not like the woman had a fun time with Aziz Ansari. And Samantha Bee jumps on that too. She's like, hold on a second. It's a Me Too backlash, which she calls the "you too loud." And she said, you know what, quote, it doesn't have to be rape to ruin your life, and it doesn't have to ruin your life to be worth speaking out about. So she's pushing back hard against people who say, ah, you went too far. This is too much. I think all these discussions are good, you know?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Aziz Ansari is embarrassed or whatever, but that's part of being a public figure, especially when, as Samantha Bee says, you know what? You wrote a book on how you're supposed to be a good guy when you're dating. So modern romance, you know, you don't get to say, you know, this isn't like it's out of your wheelhouse, buddy.
Well, I remember when that book was released, it was a bestseller. And I guess, you know, I remember, you know, how much press it got.
Well, yeah, it was a really big deal. I mean, he broke out with a nonfiction work about dating when he was, you know, a TV guy. But that you know, that really shows a big, you've got a real pull with a lot of people when you can pull something like that off.
Wait, did you say pull that off? Wait, no, I think I'm going to go back a little further into your sentence there and say, you said big and deal. So it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, well, the Huffington Post, or HuffPost as it's known, is cutting ties with bloggers. 13 years after the website was launched by Arianna Huffington and 7 years after it was sold to AOL for $315 million, HuffPost is removing access to the site for independent writers. That means
what?
You, Michael, okay? You.
What?
Yes. I know you're
Why has Arianna not returned my phone calls? Now I know.
Well, from a liberal spin on the Drudge Report, HuffPost has evolved into one of the biggest newsrooms in the world, with 550 staff members in the editorial department around the globe. Perhaps 10 to 15% of traffic to the site was driven by bloggers in recent years, but this change is no surprise. About a year or so ago, HuffPost removed the column of blog posts readers would find on the front page of different sections like sports and politics and entertainment. Bloggers were still posting items on the site, but casual readers would never see what they wrote. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. Like I said, if you were a blogger, you knew the cards were there because they didn't even post your pieces anymore. It used to be I would be on the front page of the entertainment section. You know, they had 10,000 contributors or so, and only about 8 or 10 blog posts would be actually visible at any one time, which means 99% of the people who contributed to the site were never displayed on any one page. You know, they could link, you were in the database, but no one would see them unless they were their friend and, you know, clicked on a link. So if you went to the HuffPost, most of the blogs, you never saw any stories, only a tiny, like 1%. And I was lucky enough to be one of them. And I was there pretty early on after the first 2 years. So I went from, hey, Michael, can you get me onto HuffPost? To people going, how dare you be on HuffPost? You betrayer of all freelance writers, to goodbye. We don't need you anymore.
Right. Yeah.
And I think the people who were saying, you know, you're contributing to the HuffPost and you're creating content for them and they're profiting off it and you're not getting a penny and a real writer would never write for free. All those people would post about that on Facebook and Twitter. You know, exactly. It's like, and the difference is on HuffPost, at least I was only a limited one of people, whereas on Facebook, you're one of 2 billion. So,
right.
You know, you're getting content for them for free and they're profiting wildly. So I, you know, it really is sad for me because I made the most of that platform that I could. I wish I'd gotten paid. I wish I'd, you know, jumped to some other level. But frankly, in the last few years, they've just devolved into like all videos all the time. They don't even really run a lot of print stories anymore. The front page is filled with videos. They're all about video. They're sort of a video version of the Daily Mail. They used to be a text version of the Drudge Report. Now they're video version of the Daily Mail. Gossipy, silly, and they still have their leftist, you know, politics. But it's so far divorced from actual news articles that it's a little sad.
Well, in a way, for you, it was a one way of being able to do certain things in entertainment that you wanted to do. It was also a way for you to market your other work.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I went to the Cannes Film Festival by covering it for HuffPost. I reviewed theater on Broadway for, you know, 10 years. I got access to every show on Broadway for a decade when I've never had a full-time job as a theater critic, which I would have loved and have tried to get, but they're few and far between. And so, you know what? getting to, I was writing them for free on HuffPost. I would get free tickets to see. I saw Hamilton twice. I saw every show on Broadway for many, many years. So that was a pretty great thing. It was a fair trade-off in my book. I'd rather be paid, but, you know, it kept me legitimate when I was scrambling for work, and it gave me access to stuff I could never get otherwise.
Well, speaking of journalism and journalists, the red-hot best-selling book about the Trump White House just got a little hotter. Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury has been optioned for TV by Endeavor Content. That's the new company formed in October after the merger of William Morris Endeavor and IMG. They work in partnership with Chernin Entertainment, which will handle the actual production. Wolf and former BBC exec Michael Jackson, no, not that Michael Jackson, are the only attached people, and no outlet or talent has been signed as of yet. Endeavor paid a reported seven figures for the project, which means exactly $1 million. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. I mean, they don't even say what kind of project. I mean, is it a documentary? Is it a fictionalized miniseries? It's certainly not an ongoing TV series, I assume. So it's such a vague, silly statement, and they're sort of selling it to themselves, right? Michael Wolff is repped by one of them?
Yes, exactly. I'm like, so you sold it to yourself. Hey, what was the competitive bids thing coming in? I'm waiting for the lawsuit to come down for that.
I mean, there's plenty of TV projects off of recent political insider books, so I shouldn't dismiss this entirely, but it just isn't a project that interests me. It's like, I don't really want to see people playing, you know, Steve Bannon and all these other yahoos. You know, it's plenty enough seeing them on Saturday Night Live. But the book, they finally got them in the stores. They sold 191,000 copies in hardcover in the second week of its on sale. So I'd still love to get figures on ebooks and digital audio, but the publisher ain't talking.
Well, you know, certainly, in my opinion, this project has already been made. It's called CNN and Fox News. YouTube faces a lot of problems. Some of their hot talent has created offensive videos, and some of their advertisers are upset to see their ads running alongside deeply offensive content. So YouTube is tackling the problem from all sides. Want to monetize your videos? You'll need 1,000 plus subscribers and at least 4,000 hours of watch time over the past 12 months. If you're in the Google Preferred tier, only content that has been watched and verified as quote-unquote brand safe by a human will get ads. That begins in February in the United States and by March for the rest of the world. I think I know what my kids are going to be doing for a job over the summer, Michael, watching all of our videos. In a similar attempt to tamp down criticism, Facebook has announced it won't decide which news organizations can be trusted. They're going to have you decide which news organizations can be trusted using a system that polls a wide swath of users to make judgments as to what outlets are trustworthy and which don't make the cut. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop in a way. I think YouTube is just growing up and saying, hey, you know what? Now we really have to start paying attention to these videos. I think for a lot of years, people have probably had ads next to junk and just didn't realize it. And now they need to, you know, pay more attention. And since they're cutting out most people from the monetization, it's easy to do because most people that they're cutting out made less than $100 a year on ads. That'd be people like me. If I had monetized them, I would have made a couple bucks, but it would have been less than $100 a year if you added it all up. So they said, never mind those people. They're not really where the money's at. We're going to focus on the, you know, couple hundred or couple thousand, maybe at the most, who actually have a lot of viewers and a lot of screen time and all that sort of stuff. So that makes it easier for them. They only have to pay attention to, you know, 300-400 people at the most and watch all the videos that they post. So, you know, they got to hire some interns to do that and they'll be okay. Facebook, however, what do you think about that?
Well, I think Facebook is walking down a slippery slope. I think, Facebook makes a lot of changes all the time, and this one is kind of huge. They basically, had all of these publishers posting content to Facebook that then showed up in your newsfeed, and all of these publishers began to rely on Facebook for a lot of their traffic. And I'm not going to lie, Celluloid Junkie does the same thing. Celluloid Junkie, you know, gets traffic from LinkedIn and Facebook and Twitter and other social media outlets. And, you know, over the years, we've learned how to
work within the system. Work within the system. Rules that they set to help yourself as much as possible.
But at the same time, we were helping Facebook by putting content there that people might want to see. Now they're, you know, they've had this come to Jesus moment about, I guess the last presidential election and realize, ooh, maybe some people aren't actually being honest on our platform. Yeah, no kidding. So, you know, now they're trying to figure out which news sources are trustworthy. Well, if you're going to have people decide who's trustworthy or not, you'll just get a whole bunch of your friends who are not trustworthy either to say that you are trustworthy. So I don't think that it's necessarily a good thing. I think if you either have to, you know, you have to have some set of guidelines, and having, you know, user-defined guidelines, it just doesn't work.
Well, they're going to crowdsource it. And don't you think if they have a big enough crowd, they're going to be able to separate the wheat from the chaff?
I'm certainly hoping that is the case. As for YouTube, yeah. I think I might disagree with you here a little bit. I do agree, yeah. There's people like, you know, you and I, we've done videos for YouTube when we were in Cannes. And yeah, they've, you know, initially...
They got views.
Yeah, they initially they got a lot of views. And then, you know, did we have a lot of subscribers? No. But for those people that might have 2,000 or 3,000 subscribers, thus passing the 1,000 plus subscribers, that means you have to watch every, you basically have to keep creating content to be in the 4,000 hours of watch time over 12 months. And keep in mind, sometimes these videos are kind of evergreen, like how to fix your washer or dryer, or how to iron a shirt, or, you know, you created it 3 years ago. But now the number of people who view it, it's trailing off, but yet it's still valuable to somebody.
What's your point?
That I think, you know, certainly Logan Paul, sure. Okay, they had a problem with Logan Paul, and there are other vloggers out there who have a lot of views that have, you know, 2, 3, 4 million views, viewing hours per month. But then there are people in the mid-range who are bloggers who might have, you know, just barely clear the 4,000 hours every 12 months, and if they stop and they take some time off, they might not clear it.
And so yet, what? So what?
Well,
YouTube is just saying, look, 99% of the people who create videos don't meet these standards, so we don't have to pay attention to them. It's not worth us having a whole system to deal with somebody who gets $50 a year from monetizing the ads on their videos. Why? We don't care about them. You want to keep me? You're not living off $50 a year or less than $100 a year. So to heck with you. We don't care. You know, you don't really need that money. It's not helping you. So we're just going to ignore you. We're going to focus on the people who have big audiences, and we're going to vet them, and we're going to look at all their videos. So what's wrong with that?
Well, I think it discourages people from even starting.
Well, you know, but the people do it for fun, and you know, if they turn into a big star, then they get into it and they make money and they keep going. If they're making less than $100 a year, they're not making money and they won't keep going anyway, unless it's just fun for the fun of it.
Yeah, kind of like, I don't know, doing a podcast.
Exactly. But as far as Facebook is concerned, I'm sorry to go so deep on this, but Facebook, I don't think they're going down a slippery slope. I think they're avoiding going down a slippery slope of actually making a decision. They're saying, well, we don't want to have to decide. We'll just crowdsource it. It's like, no, you can actually decide. New York Times is valid. Foxnews.com is valid. But this isn't valid. This site, okay, in Bulgaria that you've never heard of.
You're right. And in a way, that's kind of what I meant to say, was that they're avoiding the slippery slope. And in doing so, they might be hurting themselves even more.
Absolutely. And when you put aside the United States and think of there are 2 billion people worldwide, what happens in, God forbid, say, Rwanda 20 years ago, if they were around, or whenever the massacres were? You got half the people who are Hutu and the other half are Tutsi, going, Hutu and the Tutsi going, I hate all the Tutsi media and all the Tutsi people. I hate all the Hutu media. You know, you're going to get in it. You, even with a big swath of people in that country, or you have the government pushing people to not like something, you know, it gets a lot of problems in small countries where you have, you know, can sway opinion with, you know, government actions. So I think it doesn't work in a lot of countries, and government media versus, you know, independent media and all this sort of stuff and tribal stuff. It just, it's an ugly situation. I don't know if it'll work country by country. And, you know, we'll see what happens. But I think for the biggest media in the world, of course, you can know that most people will say Washington Post is trustworthy. You know, you're not going to, even with, you know, some people trying to game the system, there's so many people online, they'll be okay. You know, they'll do all right with the really big names, but they're going to get a lot of trouble when you get to smaller sites that a lot of people don't see.
Well, to your point, right before we started recording today, I read a story in, I think it was China Film Insider, actually, about how one of the big jobs now in the Chinese entertainment industry is basically being a fan. It's the fan economy. You get paid to follow, you know, a particular star or personality, and then create conversations around them on their Facebook or their Weibo or their you know.
So they seed their fandom with people who create good content to get other people engaged.
Right, and they think that basically on the Chinese version of Twitter, that really only 30% of the people are actual true followers, and the rest are all paid to be there.
Well, that's a lot of paid followers.
Yes, and it's become quite prevalent in China.
Huh, interesting.
Now, the LA Times is having a heck of a week, and that's kind of putting it mildly. First, they discover their company is thinking of opening up the LA Times to outside unpaid contributors / experts, akin to what Forbes is doing and what HuffPost just stopped doing.
Then,
Then NPR broke a story that their new boss of 6 months, publisher and CEO Ross Levinson, had a string of charges against him at previous jobs with Alta Vista and News Corp, including a frat boy atmosphere, homophobic and sexist slurs, leading to not one but two lawsuits over alleged sexual misconduct. More than 200 LA Times employees won't wait for an investigation. No, they signed a petition calling for Levinson to be fired. To top it off, the employees voted to unionize in a landslide win of 248-44. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, that's a big week.
Yeah, it's a big week.
Their company's saying, we're going to use unpaid contributors. Your new boss is a big jerk. We're going to unionize. Holy moly, your head spins. It's a big deal. You know, it's an important major newspaper. People can trust what the LA Times prints. I had that big argument over whether you can trust mainstream media. That was a lot of fun over the weekend. And we're going to see where it shakes out. But you've got the union, you know, forming, and you've got most of your employees saying you should be fired. That's got to make for an awkward staff meeting.
Yeah, well, I don't see that there's any way that Ross Levinson could continue here. But what I would say is a couple things. One, you know, these were issues that came up at previous jobs. He should have been vetted before he was ever hired. Okay, number one. Yep. And are you firing him for things he did at another job?
They're firing him because they shouldn't have hired him in the first place.
Well, that's another story entirely.
They probably knew about it. If he hid it and wasn't forthcoming, he should be fired. If the publishers knew about it and hired him anyway, they made a mistake. And in this new atmosphere, your employees are saying, you know what? You made a mistake. So, yeah, you're saying your track record shows you are not going to be a person that we trust to work over our business, and the employees are angry about it. You know, you're a gay employee at the LA Times. You find out he has, you know, slurred gay people. You happy to be working with him? Of course not.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's a...
If you find out somebody behaved like a jerk in their past job, you're allowed to say, you know what? We don't want you at our job. You know, that's okay. You're allowed to do it. You're allowed to fire somebody for what you found out they did 5 years ago? Sure you can. Why not?
Well, I mean, I guess it also depends on what's in your contract. Apparently, though, if they fire me, I think he walks away with like a $10 million payout.
Oh, undoubtedly.
Yeah. More changes are afoot at NBC's Morning Juggernaut today, and we're not talking about Hoda Kotb. It's Hoda Kotb, and I always mispronounce her name, but we're not talking that she's still going to drink Chardonnay in the 10 o'clock hour. Executive producer Don Nash is stepping down to spend more time with his family. Yeah, that's the story, and they're sticking with it. Nash has been with NBC for 23 years and the executive producer of today since 2012. NBC insists they have offered Nash other opportunities at the network and hope he'll stay. Meanwhile, an internal investigation of how the network handled the Matt Lauer scandal is ongoing. The new executive producer of today, guess who it is? Senior producer Libby Leist earned the nod. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It's another change, a major change at a huge financial machine for NBC. One can't help thinking that he was joined at the hip to Matt Lauer and that this is fallout from that.
Yes, I would agree.
No matter what they say, you just have to think, you know, this is not an accident.
Or he knew about it and just kind of looked the other way, and it's kind of all coming, you know, as they do the investigation, they're kind of saying, you know what, you probably should have said something, you didn't, that's wrong.
Or he should have known. Yeah.
MoviePass, I'm just going to end there, MoviePass. Really need to say anything else? Okay, MoviePass is getting serious about marketing. The all-you-can-eat monthly movie card has exploded from 20,000 subscribers to 20,001 thanks to Michael. No, it's exploded to 1.5 million subscribers. Okay, and that's thanks to slashing its monthly fee of $10 and lots of news coverage like what we've been giving it at CJ and here on Showbiz Sandbox. But if they want to become so big that movie studios and theater owners have to work with them, MoviePass needs to get a lot bigger. To do that, they've hired Natasha Mula of Mashable to be the company's chief marketing officer. And to those who say its business plan is flawed, MoviePass head Mitch Lowe says comparisons to a gym membership, well, they're valid. MoviePass users tend to use the service less as time goes on, which will help contain costs. Every single month, we're seeing people watch fewer and fewer movies, Lowe said. But wait, there's more. At Sundance, MoviePass made news by saying they were going to start acquiring content, start buying up actual movies, and distributing them on various platforms like theaters, streaming, and DVD, even though MoviePass has absolutely no access to any of them whatsoever. Big deal or big whoop?
Big deal, because it seems so damn stupid.
Yeah, here's what I would say. You want to become a distributor? Okay, fine. But I don't see anywhere that, I don't see you having acquisitions executives in place who can go out and actually land the films that you might need.
What would they do with them once they got them? It's just like, we're not making any money, and every person we add, we lose more and more money. So now we're going to do something completely outside of our wheelhouse that has nothing to do with our business plan, because why? It just makes no sense whatsoever. And yet they will probably keep building it up and then sell off the business and flip it and, make a lot of money by cashing out before people find out whether this can be turned into an actual business. So it just drives me bonkers, because I think, I'm working on a website. It should actually make sense and be scalable and show a profit. But that's such a silly way to think.
Well, now what they're saying, and this is MoviePass, that they are approximately 3% of the domestic box office and 10% of a particular title's domestic box office when it uses certain levers, they can actually push it up to 10%.
What are you saying? They're saying that as of this moment, they are contributing to what?
They are saying, MoviePass is saying, they contribute to 3% of domestic box office, or 10%.
As of like last week or something?
Yeah, as of last week.
So like, all right, okay. Because it's obviously not for the year or anything.
Right. Like and depending on which levers they pull, okay, and how they market certain independent films or more artistic films, they can be as much as 10% of a domestic box office for a title.
Right. So what they saw was that most of their users are in major cities. They're flourishing in New York City and LA, where a single ticket costs more than the monthly fee. If the average ticket price is $9, that's because in New York it's $14 or $15. And in Birmingham, Alabama, I can go to a matinee for $8.
Right.
Even the evening ticket prices, though, is more than $10 here. So you know what? It's not cheap here either. So they're saying, no, we're big in New York and LA, but we need to market because we want to reach people in Nashville and smaller cities and, of course, in the suburbs and countries, in the rural areas, because we want people who are in areas where we're not going to lose money on every single damn ticket we sell. So I get that, and that's why they want to market. As far as people using MoviePass less and less as time goes on, I wonder if they're confusing seasonal patterns with customer behavior.
It's funny that you should say that. I thought the same thing. I thought the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, most of their viewers, they added on in the last 6-8 weeks. And of course, they were going big in November, December, because a lot of movies came out. Now in January and February, maybe those people who care about the studios and the art films, they're not going as much because they've seen everything. And that will probably pick up again in the summer, and then it pick up again next, November and December. So, they might be confusing that.
Yeah, and I would say, there's a lot of time that you have around the holidays. You get to go to the movies a couple times. But then January hits and you got finals or you got, you're back to work and the weather's not good here in the Northern Hemisphere. You got other stuff you got to worry about until February when you go, oh my God, I better go use that thing. And then you kind of start using it in May, when all the blockbusters start coming up. But then, it's summertime in the Northern Hemisphere. So you decide to go to the beach a couple times in August and August slips by. It is a bit of a gym membership. I can tell you this, and if you were listening to the show at all, you know exactly the studios I was talking to, because I mentioned one of them previously, an executive from one of them, asked point blank, would you pay MoviePass for marketing data if it was...
Of course not.
And they said, that data, coming from an exhibitor, is mine already. I don't need to pay for it. I would never pay for it. That was said by two different studios in two different occasions to me, and it was the exact same sentiment, which is, I'm not going to pay for data that I can get from the exhibitor. They will give it to me because it's my film to begin with.
So exhibitors share information with the studios
certain information, yes.
But not all of it.
Not all, you know, certainly, you know, they're not sharing loyalty program information, but they will share, you know, certain, you know, kind of anonymized data.
Do they have to legally, anonymize. So they don't have to legally share exactly how many tickets were sold to what age group and at what level?
They don't necessarily.
I mean, that has to be in there, right?
Well, they don't necessarily, they have to, you know, how many tickets? Yes. Age group and all of that? No, that's usually worked out between the studio and the exhibitor.
Well, adult, children, and senior citizen, that would be there.
Correct, yes. That would be there.
And they wouldn't necessarily, and they would only know about who was what age if they cross-checked the credit card with the name, you know, with the ticket sold.
Well, they don't get the credit card information. The studios don't get the credit card information.
No. The theater owner wouldn't even know your age unless they paid to access and cross-check your credit card because they only know you're an adult.
Well, loyalty programs is how they do that.
Most people do not have loyalty cards. The vast majority of people, surely.
More and more they are, actually.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, millions of, I mean, you look at Cinepolis, they've got 3-4 million people in their loyalty program. You look at, you know, AMC.
Out of 150 million people who go to the movies, right?
I have no idea. That's actually a good question. I'd have to, you know what? That's a good question. What percentage of patrons are loyalty members?
Yeah. Well, you know, if MoviePass, you know, will they cut into grosses or expand them? I think they obviously the early adapters will be people in major cities who save money on every ticket and, of course, go to the movies a lot because otherwise, why the heck would you buy it? And then after that, you'll have people who go 3, 4, 5 times a year and they say, hey, you know, MoviePass, they like movies enough that suddenly they buy it and they go to more than they would. And then after that, you just have, I think most people will never buy MoviePass because they just don't go to the movies enough. So it doesn't make any sense. So I think they would probably be sort of a wash, maybe expand a little bit. I think you would get some people going more. I know I do because I like movies, but I just don't want to spend that much money. But $10 a month, suddenly I feel like I should and would, and I want to. And unlike a gym membership, you know, it's not like it's hard, you know, you just go and you have fun. But to match the box office, you know, they would need 100 million subscribers. You know, if they matched to equal the box office, they'd have to have 100 million subscribers paying $10 a month. That obviously is never going to happen. So there's a lot of people who are going to the movies that are never going to do MoviePass, and that's okay. They're going to be mostly the early adapters and casual goers who can be encouraged to go more if they have that pass. I know I do, and so it makes sense, but it doesn't work financially as a business unless they are in partnership with the theater owners and the studios.
Well, and apparently we'll also be students once they actually read a news story or two and find out that MoviePass exists.
That's right. People are still finding it out. But again, buying movies is nuts. That is so ridiculously out of what their job is. Why the hell would they spend a penny, you know, buying a movie so they can distribute it from scratch, you know, or partnering? That is, makes no sense whatsoever. It's as dumb as can be. To me, that shows them completely distracted or not understanding their business or finding value in a headline and a stupid headline that has nothing to do with their. I mean, everybody else in the house must be going, what are you talking about?
I think they're a little starstruck right now. I think, you know, they're up at Sundance right now. I think they're getting a little starstruck. I don't know what they're thinking, to be honest.
All right.
But that brings us to Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And today we're going to be talking about Ellen Pompeo, who basically she's talking about her new salary, which is a mild $20 million a year. And inspired surely by the Me Too movement, by the way, the star of Grey's Anatomy opened up about demanding the money she rightly deserves. Actress Ellen Pompeo was very specific and open, commenting on how women for so long didn't have the power to demand what they're worth. And Pompeo joked, Faye Dunaway is driving a Prius. And actually, that is true, by the way.
She said nothing wrong with a Prius, but that's ridiculous. And she's a big star and she should have a better car.
Yes. And actually, if it's anything like a couple years ago when I ran into her in Cannes and had to show Faye Dunaway how to use a USB stick, her computer was quite old as well, I might add. So she's the star of Grey's Anatomy. She went to ABC. and said, hey, yeah, you know what? I want more money. And I want a lot more money, actually. A lot more money.
Well, actually, you know, she wrote a piece for The Hollywood Reporter, and they did a long intro where they talked about her career and her ups and downs and being mentored by Shonda Rhimes and being encouraged to ask for what she's worth. And I think it's a fascinating piece. It's definitely some of the stuff that Hollywood Reporter is doing that is why they're getting a lot of magazine awards. It's a great in-depth piece. She's very honest about her deal and the points and the back and forth. And it's a fascinating read. And she likes to curse
a lot.
She clearly does not care. You read this piece and she says, you know, she says the F word constantly. So I love Ellen Pompeo now. I watched the show at the start. I watched it right through T.R. Knight's era. I stopped kind of after that because I sort of soured on it. But it's a fine drama. My sister, my niece watch it all the time. It's a long-running show. God bless them all. But boy, I love Ellen Pompeo after reading this. So her deal, and she really gives up points and talks about, you know, exactly what's going on and how it went over the years. So that's why I find it so fascinating that she's so honest about asking for stuff and not getting it and not feeling like she should ask for it and having her agents and people go, well, I don't know, maybe you shouldn't, you know? So, wow. So good for her for being that straightforward. And why not? She's on a show that she can stay on forever if she wants. She's making more money than God now. So, you know, why not be honest? So she said her deal right now is $20 million a year. That includes $500,000 per episode, a producing credit on a Grey's spinoff, back-end money, and more, adding up to that total that we have for the new season of ABC's Smash Hit. It's not like she made nothing before, but, you know, now she's really making the most she ever has. And I love this stuff about Patrick Dempsey. She said she had more leverage after Patrick Dempsey left the show and admits her people reached out to his people about teaming up for negotiations a la Friends. She said, hey, let's negotiate together. And Dempsey was like, ah, we're not interested. Why would that be? Why would that be? Because he's a man, right?
Well, and, you know, I guess they felt like he could do better on his own, whereas if, you know, they were negotiating, you know, in other words, I'll pay you $1 million or I'll pay both of you $750,000. Well, okay, great. Now I only get half of $1 million. You know, it's like, he probably felt like his agents felt I could do better. I could get a better deal for my client on their own. If I go in with somebody else, we're going to be splitting the same amount of money.
Yeah, but you know, let's not forget when she came to the show, she was a very hot property. I mean, he was a movie star. He'd made a number of movies, but she was a hot ticket in movies. She didn't even want to interview for TV. You know, she'd been in, you know, Moonlight Mile. She'd been in Catch Me If You Can. She'd been in Old School. You know, she was really on fire and doing a lot of interesting stuff when she joined Grey's Anatomy. So she was, you know, she was in Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. You know, she was a really, really hot property when she agreed to read for the show. So Patrick Dempsey, I automatically thought, oh, well, you know, he was a movie star. He, of course, would have had more money, even though the show was named after her. But in fact, you know, she was a hot, Spielberg was courting her. Other people were courting her. She was in the hottest movies around. She didn't want to get locked into a TV show. So she, in a way, had a lot of leverage too. And she was certainly on the rise where Dempsey was sort of had seemed to plateau as a movie star. But she said, all right, he doesn't want to negotiate together. At one point, she said, I want $5,000 more than Patrick Dempsey. Whatever he gets per episode, I want $5,000 more. Hey, it's named after me. I'm the lead character. And they were like, no dice. Couldn't, no way, wasn't going to happen. But the moment Dempsey was gone and they were hustling to find another actor to replace him, then she felt like, now I can step forward and get what I want.
Well, and it worked.
It certainly did. And per her agency, Grey's has generated more than $3 billion for Disney. Grey's has been drawing nearly 12 million viewers right on this season. It's their number two drama behind the new entry, The Good Doctor, the Freddie Highmore show. And the show airs in 220 territories around the world. Well, that's where a lot of that money is coming from.
Right. I'm not going to dispute that. But, you know, keep in mind the source of that information is her agency. So, of course, they're going to, you know, say it's $3 billion. Hey, even if they're off by 50%, $1.5 billion for a TV show is really, really good. But they have
13 years and 300 plus episodes in and playing all over the world and as popular as ever. Is there any reason to, I don't have any actuals on TV shows, but for this day and age, Does that seem unreasonable or wildly off?
No.
You think it's a
huge No, I don't think they're wildly off at all. I think, look, even if they're off, okay, so it's not $3 billion. It's $2.7 billion. Okay, you know, still, yeah. Please.
And of course, the networks never want to tell us what movie TV shows are making overseas. So we have to depend on people like this.
I thought it was interesting, though, that she kind of brought up Harvey Weinstein and said that she met with him in his hotel room, that there was an assistant there. Okay. And that he tried nothing. But she admits she batted her eyes and flirted to make him like her.
And that's, you know, the job. You want people to like you and find you appealing and friendly and sexy. And, you know, for the roles, that's what men do. That's what women do. People, they don't flirt with me, but they're certainly friendly and engaging in interviews. Of course, that's the job. But she's like, you know, let me not pretend I came in as a serious person, said, you know, she's like, no, I was flirting, joking, friendly, like I would be with any normal human being, having no idea he might be like that. He never tried anything, thank God. But she's had conversation with her agent 17 years later after that happened and said, you sent me into that room knowing. And she says, well, they claim they didn't know. But that clearly bothers her and, you know, makes her speak up about it. So that's sort of a shot across the bow for all agents. You know, you better be aware of stuff. And if you're not, you better be able to, you know, reassure your star that you're not putting them in danger.
Well, you know, I know somebody else who's making $20 million, actually.
Who?
Well, both Reese Witherspoon and Jennifer Aniston.
Yeah, you know, last week, in a flash-by moment, we were talking about the amount of money people make, and you were saying on TV shows, there's not a back end anymore like there used to be. I mean, Grey's Anatomy is playing all over the world. It's worth a ton of money. But in the old days, there's no syndication like there used to be. There's not even DVD and Blu-ray sales like there used to be. So actors maybe need their money up front. You know, if I was saying, why was American Gods on Stars? Why was that $10 million an episode? And how could the creators behind it say, it's not enough money, we need a bigger budget? I thought, that's insane. But apparently actors are really saying, you know what? I better get my money up front. Otherwise, I'm never going to see it.
Well, not only that, but think about it this way. The agents, remember, okay, Ellen Pompeo, she's making $20 million a year. Remember, she's not seeing all of that. Not, forget about taxes for a second, okay? She's got agents and managers and lawyers.
30% is gone for right
minimum.
30-40%.
Yeah, it's gone. And so, you know, that's one thing to keep in mind. So when you hear that Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon have signed a $1.25 million per episode deal with Apple and they're making 20 episodes, remember, they're not going to see all of that. And
right. They're getting $25 million and then they get points on the back end. And
well, there is no back end. There is no back end.
Right.
It's Apple. So, you know,
so when they say the back end, that's just means what these days? Because they did mention the back end. They got, that's like saying net points in the old days. This is sort of a polite, oh, sure.
Well, I guess it depends if they decide, okay, well, we're going to put this out on DVD or we're going to stop streaming it and we're going to make people rent it or buy it, then that would be your back end. I don't know how else you get a back end out of that. It would be interesting to find out.
Right. So that's the Apple TV show where they are competing women and morning television. And there's also, of course, Nicole Kidman is involved in the second season of Big Little Lies.
Right.
With Reese Witherspoon. And they did a mini series. There was no deal for a second season because it was a mini series based on a book with a beginning, middle, and end. No one anticipated a second season. But because it was a one-off, then they said, hey, we're going to do it again. And they had to start from scratch. So now they're getting $1 million an episode, plus producing fees and back end, whatever that means. So people are getting big bucks in television because that's where all the money and activity is, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know what a back end would mean for an HBO show, unless they're selling it to HBO Latin America. And, you know, in other words, all those are different, but I just don't know or there's DVD
sales.
It's
going to be part of their library at some point. If they ever amortize it, you want to make sure you got a piece of it. If they ever say, all right, we're going to make our HBO library available to Netflix for 6 months or whatever, you know, or something, you know,
yes,
if they ever
that's
want
true.
To do anything with it, or there's a new cable channel that focuses on, you know, maybe the own network wants to rent it 10 years down the road. Maybe they'll want to start doing that, you know, say, hey, you know, reach people more different ways.
Or airline, you know, anything, you know, any place where they license it, then certainly, you know, the profit participants could, well, take part if there's actually profit.
Right. So Apple wants to say we're big players. So they're writing big paychecks to big stars. And they're also even just saying, hey, we're here in Hollywood. We're not just up in Seattle.
Right. Actually, they are. Well, everybody, frankly, is moving to Culver City. You know, when we started Film Stew, it was in Culver City, just down the street from Sony Pictures Entertainment, like literally within walking distance. And, you know, nobody was in Culver City. It was just barren. And we moved out of there. We moved to Hollywood, and then Culver City became this hot property. And now Apple is moving in there for its all of its entertainment stuff and Beats and television. It, just everything for Apple Entertainment is moving in there. Certainly,
because they want to be closer to the creatives, right?
Well,
do they
also
have a place? Do they have an office in New York?
I don't believe so. No. Amazon is moving there as well. So Amazon Studios, IMDb, Amazon Video, they're moving to Culver City too. You know, Culver City is in between Beverly Hills and LAX, the airport in LA, and it's in between Beverly Hills and Santa Monica. It's in between Beverly Hills and Silicon Beach, which is right north of the airport.
It's basically in between.
Yeah. That said, you know, there's certainly Hollywood, which is much further east. There's the San Fernando Valley, which is much further north. So it's they've thrown down stakes and said, yeah, we're going to be a West Side company.
All right. Well, you know, at some point they're going to be sued by some of their actors, some of their creatives to show the books on these projects and say, hey, how come I haven't seen more money? I want back end. Is there no back end? What's going on here?
Yeah, and you know, Sperling and Michael aren't the only ones that want to know what the back end on an HBO show is. We do too. And people like Frank Darabont want to know what the back end of a, you know, an AMC hit show like The Walking Dead is.
That's right. Frank Darabont and his company CAA are suing AMC again. They're also, you know, there's also lawsuits by Robert Kirkman and other people who created the show. Everybody's suing everybody. They want to get an audit. They want to get stuff going. And AMC's response to the latest round of negotiations and public revelations is these people are greedy. Can you believe they said that? They're just greedy. They said they want more money. Greedy bastards.
I mean,
I thought that was the funniest comment I've ever heard. Of course they're greedy. And you're greedy if you keep money that they deserve to have.
And by the way, it's not Frank Darabont's company. CAA is Creative Artists Agency. They are his agency.
Yeah, I didn't mean it was company. Yeah, his reps. Yeah,
yeah,
I beg your pardon if I implied differently. But they were able to do an audit, and they are claiming, I don't know whether it's public documents or to the press or what, but they're claiming they found all sorts of shenanigans in the audit. For example, AMC is only reporting 20% of the revenue it has received from Apple for iTunes sales of The Walking Dead. AMC is charging too much in distribution fees for Fox's sub-distribution of Walking Dead in the international and home video markets. AMC has failed to account for certain product integration fees from Gerber and Hyundai. The Sundance International Channel, another AMC affiliate, is paying below-market license fees for Walking Dead. That'd be an example of internal dealing, self-dealing. Distribution and administration fees are being charged with respect to the music in the show, which I guess they say they shouldn't be doing. The application of Georgia tax credits has again become a point of contention. AMC is said to be improperly deducting $1.5 million in advances to other profit participants. And this is my favorite. This is how granular they're getting. Expenses include such things as a $37,600 Comic-Con banner when there's an invoice showing just half that amount. And much more. In other words, there's lots of ways to monkey around with the books, and they're looking at them all.
Yeah, well, I think that if you're getting down to the point where you're looking at invoices for a Comic-Con banner, if I were AMC, I'd say, okay, these guys are going to find something.
Well, no, but there's a lot of money when you add it all up. There's a lot of money. And, you know, their big argument has always been, well, you know what? He got the best deal he could get, so tough. He now wants more money, but he doesn't deserve it because if he could have gotten a better deal, he should. Well, guess what? Frank Darabont had a most favored nation clause. He was the big name coming into this project. He helped make it happen and launch the show's success. And he got a most favored nation clause, which means if someone else got better terms, he would get them too. And that's sort of part of like, you know what? I'm going to get the best terms because I'm the best guy, but I'm also going to make sure I don't get screwed around. Well, in a separate lawsuit, creator Robert Kirkman, the guy who created the comic books, is fighting for money, more money himself, And that's how Darabont discovered that Kirkman had better terms. Kirkman got an actual license fee rather than an imputed license fee. And that means Darabont should have gotten an actual license fee as well, but AMC hid that information from him, he says. And therefore, even if they say he couldn't get a better deal, he's like, well, Robert Kirkman did, so I should get more money.
Well, I'll tell you, if that's true, and it's borne out in the documents and in the contracts, then AMC is in a bit of trouble.
Well, how can it, you know, not be true? I mean, I'm sure, you know, we you know, he's saying, hey, this is in the public documents now of Kirkman's, you know, lawsuit. So now they've said, hey, look over there, look at that. So again, we love it when these things go public because we get to learn a little bit about an actress's back and forth with her studio and where she feels she has strength. You know, she had to wait 10, 12 years into her run on a big hit show in order to get the top dollar on the show that has her name on it. You know, that's fascinating. Actors are getting back end points on TV shows when we don't even know what back end means anymore. What's the back end for a show on Apple or HBO? And even when you get that great deal, sometimes you feel like you're not getting all the money you deserve anyway. That's what's going on with Frank Darabont and Robert Kirkman's lawsuits against AMC. So it's always fun to see how they're working these deals and all these books, and we love it.
Well, you know, normally at this point, I would try and make a horrible segue into our obituary section. But instead, I will just tell you that Hugh Wilson, the creator of WKRP in Cincinnati and the director of Police Academy films, he died at the age of 74.
That's right. He did the first Police Academy film. That was my most interesting story. He did WKRP for 4 years. It was never a big hit. It changed time slots 12 times during that 4 years. That's a lot. It really became a hit in syndication. And that actually led to 2 more years of first run in syndication for the new WKRP in Cincinnati. That's by far his biggest commercial hit, I think, in a way. He launched the Police Academy franchise. He directed some movies like The First Wives Club. Good for him. But to me, two cool things. He was a journalism major at University of Florida, where I went to school. So we had Jonathan Demme. He was the first film critic at the paper. And here's Hugh Wilson. He was a journalism major at University of Florida. So I have some connection to them. And he made 2 TV shows that were actually really, really good that never got nearly as much attention as WKRP. One was Frank's Place, starring Tim Reed. And that's where Hugh Wilson finally won an Emmy for writing the script to that show. And also the famous Teddy Z with John Cryer, a project before John Cryer went on to, what's it called?
Two and a Half Men, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, he'd been a hit in films, but Hugh Wilson saw that he could really carry a TV show. And that was a show about a loudmouth agent in Hollywood, and John Cryer was like the new young guy. So those were 2 really pretty good shows that really showed his talent in my mind. And I never realized this, but WKRP, I never got the joke. W-crap.
Yeah.
W crap. I never realized that it was WKRP. It was like, this is the worst radio station in the world. You know, a half, you know, second tier, low rent thing. I never actually caught on to that.
Well, also passing away, Oscar winner Dorothy Malone. She wrote On the Wind, Peyton Place, Rich Man, Poor Man. She died at the age of 92.
She didn't write them. No.
She's written on the wind.
She's an Oscar winner for her performance.
This is what happens when you're trying to read the news. She wrote On the Wind.
I don't know. So Walter Cronkite, not such a dumb guy after all.
No, he actually knew what he was doing.
Yeah, she segued into TV with Peyton Place, and she was in one of the first, if not the first, depending on how you define it, Rich Man, Poor Man, one of the big miniseries of all time, helped make Nick Nolte a star. She died at 92, and dying at a much younger age is the producer Alison Shearmer.
She's kind of well known, actually. It's kind of a shame.
Yeah, well, of course. She died at 54. She worked on the Rogue One Star Wars spinoff, and also on the upcoming Han Solo movie, and also oversaw the Hunger Games movies. So, a producer in her prime. So she died as well. And of course, we got an update on Tom Petty. His family, whether they suspected that it would come out anyway, or they felt like, hey, they can do some good for people, they wanted to come out and make a statement saying Tom Petty died of an accidental drug overdose. He was on medication for a lot of pain because he had his hip was really hurting. It was essentially broken again. He was going to need more surgery, but he was touring and he accidentally just took too many opioids. And they said, hey, you know what? This is a real danger. It was accidental. It was not, and he was in real serious pain, but he was so having a great time on the tour and didn't want to stop yet. And he unintentionally OD'd and killed himself by being on opioids and not being careful enough. And so they were hoping that if they came forward and spoke about this first, maybe somebody else can save their life by making sure they're doubly careful about what they're doing. You know,
yeah,
when you're in a lot
I don't want to go into it. Yeah, I don't want to go too much into this, but, because you could really just, go down a rabbit hole here. But what I would say is when you read what's going on with Tom Petty, or what went on with him, he basically, for 40 of the 53 shows, had an injured hip, which slowly migrated into a fractured hip. And ouch. To do the shows, he was taking certain pain medication, not nearly as strong as the opioids. And then I guess over time, by the time he ended the tour, and keep in mind, when you've got a 53 city tour, that's a train that's kind of hard to stop. I guess you can if you really need to. And so
obviously you should have. Yeah. And it's a shame. And knowing to say no is, and it throws everybody out of a loop, and you're making great money. You're having some of the best shows in your life, and you always feel like you don't have the ability to say no, but sometimes you need to, whether you're, someone who's out of control, like Amy Winehouse, who didn't know enough to say no, or Tom Petty, who, because of the pain and the slow gradation and the increase of what he was taking, probably didn't realize, according to them, what was going on, and that he was, dangerously upping his dosage, because it happened over weeks or months or whatever.
Well, I think more to the point, he probably had a higher dosage, then didn't have a high dosage, and then returned to a high dosage. And that's what I mean by I don't want to get too far into this, but that's really what does it for these people. The same thing happened with Prince, where he was on a very high dosage. He basically stopped for a day or two and then took a medium dosage, and that's what killed him. Same thing here. He was on a fentanyl patch, which is basically a patch that has the drug on it, and then he mixed it accidentally with other drugs, and that
A lot more about opioids than I thought.
They are incredibly dangerous, and people, think about it this way. More people have died of opioids in the past 10 years than died during World War II.
You mean U.S. soldiers?
Yes, U.S. soldiers.
Yeah, because a lot of people died in World War II.
Yeah.
Hundreds of millions of people, more than 100 million people worldwide. So, a lot of people, or at least certainly 50 or 80 million people. I mean, Russia lost 30 million people
20,
alone?
20 million, yeah.
Well, that doesn't include the famines and the hunger, though.
Oh, no, no, that's just soldiers and, yeah.
Yeah, just soldiers. Good God. Yeah, so a good warning. I'm not on opioids, but I'll make sure I'm careful. But, good for them, for whatever reason they did, to be honest and open and talk about it, to say, hey, maybe somebody can learn,
Yeah.
A tragic mistake.
Well, it's a sad...
And it was a tragic mistake to record at night. I kind of wondered in the back of my mind, I wonder if we'll be a lot snappier and quicker if we record in the evening. The answer is no.
No, we're just as long-winded when we're tired and have a glass of wine in us. So, yeah, that's probably why this show is now probably 3.5 hours long. you can actually subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. If they still allow us to put podcasts in that are this long, you can find us there. You can rate and review us there. It does help us out when you do. You can find that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find those ways to contact us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. You can like us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, all of that information, as well as links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's show, can be found on showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They have their own website, who is mgmt.com. And they are actually about to release a new album on February 9th. And their worldwide tour starts in Berlin on January 30th. Tickets are on sale now. And in fact, unfortunately, they're playing Los Angeles on May 18th in the middle of Cannes. I called them and asked them to reschedule. They said no.
And we've got links to 3 new videos of theirs in our show notes, and it can also be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com.
Is MySpace still a thing? I guess it is. In any case, Michael, you have a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
Yeah, this week, don't look for me on Huffington Post. Actually, all my stuff is still archived there. You can look for my name. But yes, my website this week is Ellen Pompeo is effing awesome. .com.
And she would have spelled that out, by the way, just so you know.
I wanted to save you the bleeping effort, you know, to bleep me out.
I appreciate that, because only CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, and apparently the President of the United States can use those words without, you know, having them bleeped. Okay, well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage there, as he mentioned, you can still find some of his older coverage on the Huffington Post or michaelgiltz.com, where all of his current work is archived. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com to know what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.